Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, March 8th. Hope you're doing well. Man, feels like spring out there this morning where I'm broadcasting from. Just absolutely beautiful. And makes me think that Phil from Punxsutawney was correct, which is a good thing. I'm not sure what his batting average is, but hitting a home run so far this year. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to be on the program at all today. 573-4BREAD-4 is the number that you can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I'll have a question of the day that I give you in the next segment, but anything on your mind, you're free to call in. Got a couple of guests in the next hour. Gary Montgomery, who was a former sports reporter, now a Catholic evangelist and catechist. He's going to be on the program. Catechist, just a fancy word for teacher. And Gary Montgomery, not exactly a teacher who has a job for the faint of heart. He teaches eighth graders and has for many years, but he's also an evangelist. And actually, he'll be speaking here in the Lexington, Kentucky area. But we'll hear a little bit about his story and how he sees his role as sharing Christ the light. Also, bottom of the next hour, author Stephen Ryan with a fascinating column about Ernest Hemingway and the Blessed Mother. Now, you know, Ernest Hemingway, of course, a great novelist, but never seen as a religious person. If anything, more of an existentialist, that a real man grabs and shapes and molds his own reality. And of course, Hemingway famously known for taking his own life when that reality that he could shape would no longer satisfy him. But evidently there was at least a fondness for the Blessed Mother in Ernest Hemingway's life. So Stephen Ryan will fill us in on that. Also, how to identify authentic anti-Catholicism. It's sometimes been called the last acceptable American prejudice, anti-Catholicism, with deep roots. I want us to be able to identify what authentic anti-Catholicism is so that we can be honest about it. In other words, to not be shrill and look for anti-Catholicism when in fact it is not there. And I'll explain that in light of a TV show coming up, I believe it is on ABC, as well as in light of the recent Spotlight film and some other things. Also, unlikely praise for Nancy Reagan, or did I already mention that? I may be getting early dementia. And how the nuns love Bernie. Now, I'm not saying nuns, N-U-N-S, love Bernie. Who knows? There could be some of those who do too, but N-O-N-E-S, those who claim no religious affiliation. So all that and more in the program today. Of course, we'll spin the dial of catechism. We'll look back in history and give out our What Were You Thinking awards, all the rest coming at you. We'll also talk a little bit about Peyton Manning and his big announcement yesterday. Again, 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you. Hope you had a great day yesterday. After the show, I had a fairly busy day. Went down yesterday afternoon to meet with a young couple who are getting married. I am in my full-time work, the director of family life for the Diocese of Lexington, which is a pretty large spread, 50 counties in southeastern Kentucky. Of course, we Kentuckians, in our state, we have 120 counties. Given that we're not a huge state geographically, that's quite remarkable. People, particularly in the eastern part of the state, identify by their county oftentimes. But 50 counties. And so once you get outside of the central Kentucky area, where there's about 10% of the population are Catholic, you get out into some areas where there are very, very few Catholics. And this couple was from a little town in southeastern Kentucky, and they're getting married. And so I was meeting with them to go over with them the results of a survey that a lot of engaged couples take called FOCUS. FOCUS with two C's, which stands for the Facilitating Open Couple Communication, Understanding, and Study. Now, many couples mistakenly call it a test. It's not a test. It's not a compatibility evaluator, which you can pass or fail. It's basically just meant to surface issues to discuss things that you may have taken for granted or you may not have gotten around to talking about as you prepare for marriage. Just had a great time. Really, really, really nice young couple and very confident about their future together. Not that they won't have struggles. I mean, married life, by its very nature, brings about struggles because you're taking these two different personalities and temperaments and you're bringing them together as one. And as I always like to say to engaged couples, you know, we romanticize this idea of becoming one. We think of it in terms of our strengths. I'm sharing my strengths with your strengths, and together, just think how strong we'll be. But marriage is also about sharing weaknesses, and you know, and that's part of the struggle. And marriage being this school of love, in which we have surfaced within us all the ways that we tend to turn in on ourselves rather than open ourselves up to the other. So they're in for an adventure, but and pray God's blessings upon them as they walk this path, because really, really, like I said, nice, enjoyable, and got a chance to get out and drive a little bit yesterday, which, believe me, when you're the father of seven, sometimes just having some time out on the open road is not a bad thing at all. So thankfully, I didn't fall asleep at the wheel, which sometimes late afternoon drives I can fall into sometimes. Going to this same town a number of years ago on an afternoon when I was really exhausted, I was awakened by the rumble strips on the side of the road. And the bad thing is, I was awakened by the rumble strips on the right side of the road on my left driver's side tires, which means I drifted quite a bit. So anyway, I don't know why I mentioned that, but I'm glad I'm back safely. Today's readings, if you look at the book of Ezekiel, the first reading, you've got this vision Ezekiel has of the temple. This is late in the work of the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel, who had a difficult job of preaching and teaching at a time when Israel was in exile to the Babylonians. But he has this vision of restoration, and the vision of restoration really centers around the temple of the Lord. This first reading, the angel brought me, Ezekiel, back to the entrance of the temple of the Lord. Now remember, the temple had been decimated, desecrated. This great locus of God's presence with his elect people, Israel, which culminated in the building of the temple of Solomon and the descent of the presence of the Holy and the Lord right in the midst of it. This was Israel's crowning moment. Now all that's been stripped away, but Ezekiel, as all the prophets do, even in their words of judgment and discipline and chastening, they have a word of hope. And the hope was that the temple would be restored. And Ezekiel has this vision of the temple, and I saw water flowing out, he writes, from beneath the threshold of the temple toward the east. For the facade of the temple was toward the east. The water flowed down from the right side of the temple, south of the altar. And then as he expands out from there, he sees the water flowing out and getting increasingly deep the farther he gets away from the temple. Now there's a river through which he could not wade, for the water had risen so high it had become a river that could not be crossed except by swimming. And the angel said, "Have you seen this, son of man?" And then he brought me to the bank of the river where he had me sit. And Ezekiel says, "Along the bank of the river I saw very many trees on both sides, and where the water was flowing down through these different districts. And this water emptied into the sea, into the salt water, which it makes fresh. And along this river," says, "every sort of living creature will multiply and live. There'll be abundant fish. And from wherever this water that comes, the sea shall be made fresh." This healing power, this purifying power of the water that flows forth from the temple. "And along the banks of the river, fruit trees of every kind shall grow. Their leaves shall not fade, for their fruit fail." It's really a breathtaking in your imagination of this nourishing, healing water flowing in increasing depth out from the restored temple. Now, it's not surprising then that the gospel reading is from the Gospel of John, because there is a connection. Now, as I've talked about before, John's gospel has a definite and clear parallel to the book of Genesis, right? So you've both books start in the beginning, in Genesis, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth. In John 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Not for nothing do those two books begin with the same three words, and there are many parallels between the book of Genesis and the Gospel of John, because Genesis is about the first creation, John is about Christ's recreation of that which has fallen. But there's another Old Testament connection, and that is the connection between John's Gospel and the prophet Ezekiel. And particularly this vision and focus on the temple. Because we see, as we'll see going through John's Gospel, and we'll have to pick this up at the beginning of the next hour as well, John makes very clear that the temple, the restored temple, is Jesus himself, his own body. There's that great verse in John's prologue that says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." As I've mentioned before, the original Greek there in which John was written could be literally translated, "And the Word pitched its tent among us." The tent, evocative of the tabernacle built for God's presence as they traveled through the wilderness. The temple, which was the fulfillment of the tabernacle. Now Jesus, the temple of temples, God's presence among us. We'll pick this up next hour. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show on this Tuesday, March 8th. My question of the day, it is Lester Holt's 57th birthday. Lester Holt, who inherited the NBC Nightly News anchor after Brian Williams stepped down in embarrassment. And, you know, Lester Holt, I think he used to be on the Today Show, seems like a really good guy. Anyway, 57 years old today. I'm asking a question. Which major network news anchor do you like the most? Or maybe even do you trust the most to be balanced and fair? I mean, do you even still watch the major network news? ABC, NBC, CBS, and so forth. You know, it is not the heyday of network news by any means. Now, I don't know Lester Holt personally, but I do have a good friend whose son won a contest years ago through National Geographic, and got to go on a trip, he and his son together, when his son was, I don't know, maybe about 10 years old. And they got to go down to Africa, to South Africa, did all kind of great stuff, including shark cage diving and all kind of crazy stuff. But Lester Holt was the correspondent who traveled with them on the trip, so they got to know him and had nothing but good things to say about Lester Holt. Like I said, seems like a good guy. My question is, who is the news anchor that you trust the most? And we're looking for current, right? I mean, I got a couple comments on the show's Facebook page of people saying, you know, Walter Cronkite. Well, I mean, and that's the way it is. I mean, Walter Cronkite, a great guy, obviously, but no longer active in the NBC News. Is even still, I think he passed away. Anyway, like somebody else mentioned, Paul Harvey. So if you've got a thought on that, love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text, or you can email MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I'm not sure why it is, but when I watch a major network news, on the rare occasion that when the 6:30 news hour rolls around and I turn on one of the major networks, I gravitate toward ABC. I don't know if it's just habit or what. I don't usually watch Lester Holt. No offense. Whoever does CBS, I don't watch, but ABC for some reason. But what about you? Give me a shout. Love to hear from you. Of course, the big sports news yesterday, Peyton Manning making official what had been expected, so no surprise that he was retiring after 18 years in the NFL. He talked about the significance of the number 18, and you know, he, of course, wore number 18, so 18 years seemed like a good thing. A very emotional press conference. I want to play a couple of clips of it for you. one of the, I thought, really, and it was, in my opinion, I watched some of it this morning. He really, it was a model press conference. I thought it was just emotional enough that gave you a sense that of what the game of football has meant to him and how blessed he feels like he has been by the people in his life. And he was very careful to go through going all the way back from his early days in New Orleans, his hometown, and the support that he received there, all on through his days at the University of Tennessee, of course, his experience with the Colts and others. He was, and the Broncos, it was about a 10-minute press conference. He mentioned so many different people. You really got a sense that if he's faking a persona of genuine humility, then he's doing a pretty good job of it, and somebody should give him an Academy Award. Because it was, I thought, fairly refreshing. But one funny story he told was when he first started off with the Colts, and of course they were pretty abysmal, and a conversation that he had with his grandfather. He'll let you a little of this.
In the beginning of my time in Indy, the team's struggles were agonizing. My grandfather would call me weekly to ask if his favorite announcers, John Madden and Pat Summerall, would be broadcasting our game. Pawpaw, I'd say, we're only 2-8 right now. We're playing the 3-7 Bengals. Madden and Summerall don't broadcast those kinds of games. Fast forward to my second year when we had gotten things going a little bit. We were playing the Dallas Cowboys, including Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Michael Irvin, and Deion Sanders. I called Pawpaw. Guess what? Madden and Summerall are broadcasting the game. He said, I can't believe it. He was elated. He was very proud. And we beat the Cowboys that week. And we let the world know that the Colts had arrived. Make no mistake about it. We were coming. And we went on to do some phenomenal things, like winning at least 12 games 7 years in a row. And, of course, winning Super Bowl 41. And I was truly honored and proud to be a part of it.
So that was pretty cool right there. I thought, I love hearing a story about his pawpaw. And again, you could see sense the emotion in his voice. Now, a little bit later, toward the end of the press conference, you really got the sense of what drove Peyton Manning. You know, what was it that that motivated his legendary preparation, all the effort that he put into the game? He said, don't think for a minute that it had anything to do with simply my drive, but his whole attitude toward the game of football. We'll pick this one back up. Thanks, Ethan.
Pundits will speculate that my effort and drive over the past 18 years were about mastery and about working to master every aspect of the NFL game. Well, don't believe them, because every moment, every drop of sweat, every bleary-eyed night of preparation, every note I took, and every frame of film I watched was about one thing: reverence for this game. When I look back on my NFL career, I'll know without a doubt that I gave everything I had to help my teams walk away with a win. There were other players who were more talented, but there was no one who could out-prepare me. And because of that, I have no regrets. There's a scripture reading, 2 Timothy 4:7. I have fought the good fight, and I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Well, I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time. God bless all of you, and God bless football.
All right, so that's good. God bless football. America's religion. No doubt. No, that really, I like that. I think Peyton Manning's going to have some soul searching to do, because I think as a lot of great athletes, when you reach the end of your playing days, and in some ways almost felt like a self professed eulogy there. But I mean, he's got, I'm sure, a bright future ahead, and I'm sure he'll be in studio and he'll be giving his analysis of games, if he wants to do that. There'll be no limit to what Peyton Manning will be afforded the opportunity to do. So anyway, but I thought it was a very touching press conference. It's hard for me to imagine how you could dislike Peyton, though. I'm sure there are people out there who do. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to comment. 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Of course, there is a lot of difficulty going on at the University of Tennessee, and there was an interesting piece I saw yesterday about, you know, of course, Peyton mentioned in that Title IX lawsuit going back to his playing days at Tennessee. But it's a much bigger issue than that. And ESPN had an article yesterday called College Football Finally Getting Serious About Culture Change. And, you know, talking about, you know, you've got these extensive charges at Tennessee related to sexual harassment and all sorts of things. And the very honest article about the culture of secrecy, good old boys network, all those sort of things in the college game that really have to start changing and are starting to change. And, you know, as we've talked about before, any big institution that has a lot to lose can have the tendency to protect the institution, guard the institution over the needs of the individual. It's happened in the Catholic Church, no doubt. It's an issue and a culture that we are having to change in that regard as well. And it's happening in athletics and needs to happen a lot of other places as well. So hopefully that'll be a positive development out of a lot of negative press coverage for sure. Anyway, let's get on to the What Were You Thinking awards for the day. We've got a few nominees. All right, so spanning the globe, finding examples of poor human decision-making. This out of the Southern Daily Echo. Not sure where this is from, but anyway. Anthony Stallard fined for pretending to be a ghost in a cemetery in Portsmouth. A man who pretended to be a ghost by shouting "woo-hoo-hoo" at mourners in a cemetery has been fined. Really? I'm all for being a prankster, but mourners? Anthony Stallard had been kicking a football around in a Hampshire graveyard with a friend while also making spooky noises close to people to the people visiting the graves of their loved ones. Prosecutor Tim Concannon said he was throwing himself backwards, waving his arms and going, "Woo!" I'm assuming he was pretending to be a ghost. Yeah, not a classy move. How about this? A Romanian mayor accidentally built a villa for his wife on an archaeological site. Oops. It was a nice gesture, of course, but he built it over two archaeological dig sites that were discovered in 1970. Initially, it went unnoticed until a team of archaeologists mapping the local sites in the county stumbled upon it. Hmm. Might want to do over there, but this one takes the cake. Here's our winner. A former Chelmsford, Massachusetts man charged with trying to hire a hitman to kill his estranged wife has been convicted of trying to hire someone to kill the undercover state trooper who had posed as the hitman. I mean, where does it end, Andrew S. Gordon? So you wanted a hitman to kill your wife, then you wanted a hitman to kill the hitman. Maybe, you ought to think twice. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show on this March 8th. Question of the day on Lester Holt's 57th birthday. Lester Holt, who is the anchor for NBC News, taking over for the disgraced Brian, never saw a dishonest tale that I didn't like, Williams, stepping in for him, and he's kept the seat. My question is, who's your favorite network, major network news anchor, or who do you trust the most? 573-4-BREAD-4, you can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Big election day here. We've got primaries in, let's see, a Republican caucus in Hawaii, Republican primary in Idaho, and then both Republican and Democratic races in Michigan and Mississippi. And then you've got, let's see, next Tuesday will be another big one where you've got Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and Ohio, as well as the Northern Mariana Islands Republican caucus. I'm sure the world will be watching that. My guess is by next Tuesday, we'll sure know a lot more about how the race is going to shape up. And it appears to be, unless John Kasich can make some sort of headway today in Michigan and perhaps win Ohio next week, it looks like on the Republican side, it's pretty much a two-candidate race. And I guess we'll see whether or not Bernie Sanders can make up any ground on Hillary Clinton. Came across an interesting piece in the Christian Science Monitor. The unseen side of Bernie Sanders' young voter revolution. And really talked about this popularity that Bernie Sanders has among the young, but particularly among the young nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those who claim no religious affiliation. As this article says, Sanders' appeal to young liberals through his views on inequality, health care, and college tuition are well known, but less examined is his connection to young Americans' faith. Sanders' view is one of a spirituality not grounded in any religious tradition. It is instead tied to a deep sense of human interconnectedness. This view resonates with a growing number of millennials, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, who follow no specific religion. As the article says, to some, these nuns could even be a potential Democratic counterpoint to conservative evangelicals. In 2012, some 70% of the nuns voted for Barack Obama, just as 79% of conservative evangelicals, who also make up about a quarter of the U.S. population, voted for Mitt Romney. Now, Carter Turner, professor of religious studies at Radford in Virginia, said that that kind of political clout for the nuns, the kind of political clout, for example, evangelicals have, would appear to be a long way off, precisely because nuns, N-O-N-E-S, just to clarify, don't have centralized organizations. They don't have the networks that come with centralized organizations. They don't have shared rituals that unify, and they don't even share a very specific agenda. I think it's fair to say they share a moral commitment to fairness as they understand it. But that's not enough to make them a reliable religious political subset with the potential to rival evangelicals. But still, their rise illustrates some of the ways millennials could influence politics. John Green, the director of the Ray Bliss Institute of Applied Politics, said, "Wind back the clock 40 years, and you could say the same thing about the evangelical Protestants." So that will be interesting. Since 2007, evidently, nuns have grown from 16% of the U.S. population to 23%. And during that time, the share of nuns, those that have no religious affiliation, believe the share of them that believe in God has shrunk from 70 to 61%. So they're not only growing as a share of the U.S. population, they're becoming more secular over time. And as we said, Bernie Sanders resonates with them. And there's a shared sense of spirituality. I'm making air quote signs there. So that's something that Bernie has evidently tapped into. Of course, over the weekend, another quasi-political development, I guess, would be the passing of Nancy Reagan. One of the things that saddens me to see, I guess it's the fruit of this partisan climate that we're in right now, but when you have a person, a very clearly identified political figure, identified with either conservatism or liberalism, Republicans or Democrats, it doesn't, the body's not even cold before the knives come out. That's why it was refreshing to see on the left-leaning website, The Daily Beast, a very positive remark from Eleanor Clift about Nancy Reagan, who passed away Sunday at the age of 94. Eleanor Clift said, Nancy Reagan became first lady during the height of the feminist movement, and women who were battling for their rights in a male-dominated world saw her as an anachronism. Reagan said her life began when she met her husband. The adoring look she focused on her, Ronnie, when they were in public, became known as the gaze, adding to the caricature of her as a rich Hollywood socialite who did not understand the concerns of a generation of women coming into their own as professionals and seeking equality. I never know what it is about some feminists. Now, I say some feminists because, you know, St. John Paul II considered himself an authentic feminist, and others. In other words, the belief in the equality of dignity of the woman, the appreciation of the feminine genius is something that's actually deeply rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And so you can be an authentic feminist believing in the equality, the value, the dignity of a woman and of women without buying every aspect of, I think, some of the distortions of the feminist movement that don't really seem to appreciate femininity at all, but see it as problematic. Some who see feminism primarily about women being just like men. And I think we can believe in equality of dignity without believing in sort of a flatlined gender sameness. This was part of the consternation that cropped up with some people when Adele, for the very popular British singer, said she found her purpose in motherhood. Slate Magazine running a piece, Adele tries squaring feminism with finding purpose in motherhood. Why do you have to square motherhood with femininity? I mean, with feminism. Isn't feminism an affirmation of the best of femininity? And certainly written into femininity is the potential to bring new life into the world, just as written into the nature of masculinity is the potential to father a child. But Adele had evidently said that her son makes me very proud of myself. When I became a parent, I felt like I was truly living. I had a purpose where before I didn't. My main thing is mom, then it's me, then it's work. And as Slate Magazine said, this is a bold, potentially controversial statement for a celebrity mom. What? That's controversial? Anyway, I digress. So back to Nancy Reagan. Eleanor Clift, though, with a very positive piece, she said what her detractors failed to understand, and I was among them, was the substantive role she played behind the scenes at the White House in keeping her husband's presidency on track. She took the long view in looking after his legacy, intervening through favored surrogates to keep conservative ideologues from driving the agenda. Her insistence that no president could be considered great without reaching out to Soviet leaders trumped resistance from the right wing of the GOP. It's a very positive article about the former first lady who, as I said, died Sunday at the age of 94. And it's the kind of thing that just gives you a little bit of hope that amidst all the partisan rancor, we can talk decently about each other. And we can see virtue. It doesn't mean we have to agree or affirm everything a person stands for, but that we can look for the good in each other. Perhaps this is a good model for moving us forward to a greater spirit of cooperation. So thanks for that piece, Eleanor Clift. So let's look back in history. What are some other things March 8th over the years that have happened?
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
All right, so on this day in 1841, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, was born. Following his death on March 6th, 1935, his obituary appeared in the New York Times. Oliver Wendell Holmes, interesting, I'd like to do a little bit more study on him. He had some perspectives that don't really jibe well with the Catholic worldview, for sure. In 1884, Susan B. Anthony addressed the U.S. House Judiciary Committee arguing for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution granting women the right to vote. Her argument came 16 years after legislators had first introduced a federal women's suffrage amendment. The tip of the hat to Susan B. Anthony for persistence. It would be a while before that would materialize in the amendment that gave women the right to vote. On this day, in 1930, Babe Ruth signed a two-year contract for $160,000. New York Yankee GM Ed Barrow predicted no one will ever be paid more than Babe Ruth. On this day, 17 years ago, Baseball Hall of Famer Joe DiMaggio died at the age of 84. Sad day for baseball, indeed. And on this day, 80 years ago, the first stock car race ever held at Daytona Beach, Florida. Not a big stock car racing fan, but I will say Daytona is pretty much a mecca in that regard. We'll be back to talk about real anti-Catholicism. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Little REO Speedwagon. That song number one back in 1985. That one of the most singable, you know, one of those songs for me anyway. If I'm in the car by myself or with members of my family, I wouldn't subject non-family members to this. But when this song comes on the radio, it's cranked up and it is karaoke time. It's singing with all your money. It's just nobody did power harmonies like REO Speedwagon. It's one of those songs, you know, kind of like the Journey song, Don't Stop Believing. You know, you just got to sing it when it plays. At least that's me anyway. Speaking of REO, I remember being in the high school band, not exactly the quintessential expression of coolness, but my band director always trying to make things hip back in the day. Back in the 80s, right around the time REO Speedwagon was in. And we were practicing this marching band number part of our show, Russian Easter Overture. Get that? Russian Easter Overture. And he was talking to us through his megaphone, as he liked to do. And he said, you know, band, if anybody asks you what you're working on this year for your show, just tell them you're playing a little REO. Russian Easter Overture, you get it? Rimshot. And you wonder why band people were made fun of. Oh, well. Solidarity. The struggle is real. 5734-BREAD-4, if you want to give me a call. My question of the day, it's Lester Holt's 57th birthday. And I'm asking, who is your favorite major network news anchor? You know, that word is in itself, anchor. They sit behind the desk dispensing truths about the news. Who do you trust? 5734-BREAD-4, 5734-BREAD-4. You can call or text. By the way, other big news story breaking out yesterday, evidently on March 15th. What's that, a week from today? Pope Francis is going to announce some news about the canonization of Blessed Mother Teresa, which people have simply assumed is just a matter of time, but when and where it's going to happen. So we look forward to hearing about that. I want to talk about anti-Catholicism just a little bit. L'Osservatore Romano, the newspaper out of Italy, coming out with an editorial about the film Spotlight, which recently won the Academy Award for Best Picture. And as you know, it is a film that depicts the unfolding of the sexual abuse scandals in the Archdiocese of Boston. And in many ways, the culture of secrecy that had helped protect priest abusers from accountability, from being moved around and so forth. Telling the story of the Boston Globe, who won a Pulitzer, I think, for uncovering the scandal. And of course, I only watched part of the Academy Awards. I had to get in bed so I could get up to do this show. But I wondered if Spotlight might win, and I wondered a little bit about what the, you know, of what the acceptance speech would be like and so forth. And it did win, and there were remarks about the church and about power and about the Pope, even calling on Pope Francis to protect children and so forth. There have been reaction from some Catholics of shouting out that Spotlight is must be an anti-Catholic film because it's a film from Hollywood about the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. Now, I have not seen Spotlight. It is back into our local theaters again after winning Best Picture, probably just for this week. So I need to try to make sure I get over there and see it, because as somebody who works for the church, who works for a diocese, who is acquainted with the underbelly of the church, because anybody who works for the church sees that, yes, we are a divine institution. We also are a very human institution. So I've been wanting to see, because I think there's a cautionary tale in Spotlight. But this op-ed piece in L'Osservatore Romano about the film says it's not an anti-Catholic film. Spotlight, the Oscar-winning film, has a compelling plot, it says. The film is not anti-Catholic, as it has been written. Well, looks like we got a call. We have to get back to this in just a minute. Henry calling up on line one. Henry, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
Doing all right.
I'm good.
I think I know. I know this, Henry. What's going on?
My mom told me I'd be on radio one day. No, I don't know if I am or not. But, hey, listen, I want to let you know there's a update you on the traffic at Manawar and Richmond Road. There's something going on there. A lot of cops. I just happen to look behind my rearview mirror whenever they do detoured everybody. But
okay.
I just wanted to pass that on to you.
Yeah, absolutely. We sure will do that. Henry, you doing well?
Yeah, doing good.
All right.
I'm hanging in there. I'm enjoying your show.
Well, thanks, Henry. Thanks for the update. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's hard to get in with split phone, 1-800 or whatever the number is, 4-RED-4. But, you know, you got to hit these little buttons for a letter.
Well, you made it, man. All right, Henry. Take care, brother.
All right, I'll see you, Mike.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Anyway, so... yeah, if you're in the Lexington, Kentucky area where we broadcast from, then watch out for at Richmond Road and Man of War. Evidently, something going on there. Thanks, Henry, for the update. That's actually my wife's brother, Henry. So great to hear from him. Anyway, so back to this film, Spotlight. L'Osservatore Romano saying that this is not an anti-Catholic film. It says Spotlight, the Oscar-winning film, has a compelling plot. The film is not anti-Catholic, as has been written, because it manages to voice the shock and profound pain of the faithful confronting the discovery of these horrendous realities. In other words, I mean, what I think they're saying is the church is not just the hierarchy. The church is the entire body of Christ. And therefore, if you have a film that is exposing some corruption, perhaps the culture of secrecy, whatever it is, but it's doing it in defense of Catholics, then how can the film be anti-Catholic? As it says, of course, the narrative does not delve into the long and tenacious battle that Joseph Ratzinger, as prefect for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and as Pope, undertook against pedophilia in the church, but one film cannot tell all. And the difficulties that Ratzinger met with do not but confirm the film's theme, which is that too often, ecclesiastical institutions have not known how to react with the necessary determination in the face of these crimes. And I'll post this on the show's Facebook page. But here's the thing that I guess the point that I want to make. We as Catholics have to be very, very careful that we don't sound shrill when we holler anti-Catholic. There is definitely anti-Catholicism in our culture, and there really has been in our country since the very beginning in days. I mean, our English roots, there is an anti-Catholic undercurrent in this country. In fact, as Bishop Jerome Listecki wrote in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel recently. He said, noted historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has called anti-Catholicism the deepest held bias in the history of the American people. But we have to be able to recognize authentic anti-Catholicism with things that are not really anti-Catholic. And so, for example, Spotlight, though I have not seen it, and I'm sure it's not a pleasant film to watch if you're Catholic, but it's not anti-Catholic because it is not anti-Catholic any more than you could call the Old Testament prophets anti-Israel. Because anytime there is a challenge or a call for the church to live up more fully to her teachings, that is not anti-Catholic. Any more than you could call, let's say, Martin Luther King Jr. anti-American for his I Have a Dream speech and calling us to make good on that promissory note of the Declaration of Independence, that all people are created equal. In other words, if ever someone is calling out Catholics to be who we say we are, to be more faithful to what we say we believe about the human person, about the priority of the individual over the institution and so forth, then that is not anti-Catholic, and we need to be able to receive that. Now, what is anti-Catholic? It's anti-Catholic when you actually bash the Catholic Church for her teachings. Now, that is anti-Catholic. In other words, you are hating Catholicism according to its very nature, not for failing to live up. So, for example, I got into a sort of a back and forth on Facebook on this whole issue of the seal of confession, this idea that those who hear confessions cannot reveal to the police or to anyone, even to the person who confessed it, anything they heard in the confessional. And people bash the Catholic Church for that, for the seal of confession, which is intrinsic to the sacrament of confession. Now, that, in my opinion, is anti-Catholic because you're attacking the church simply for who she is and what she stands for. Also, this series that's getting ready, that's starting with from ABC called The Real O'Neills, which basically portrays all Catholics with a very jaundiced eye as self-righteous hypocrites who have all these family secrets that they don't want exposed. And when you invite Dan Savage, Savage Love Advice columnist and homosexual activist, who has made clear his disdain for Christian teachings, when you bring him on, ex-Catholic, to guide you, now that's anti-Catholicism. But we have to be able to tell the truth from the false. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.